Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycast.
There is a queer angle to every issue, and we will find it. Don't expect us to be nice. Don't expect it to be safe. And don't expect us to be politically correct. Nothing is sacred. We find the queer, profane, and cringeworthy wherever we can, here on Joy 94.9. Is nothing
what
sacred?
Is about? There's something evolving.
In the studio with me, Steph. Hello, Steph.
Hello, Jim.
James on the panel again.
Hello.
Hello, James.
And we've got a show tonight with Natalie Croom, who we've had before on the show, and we'll be talking to from Sydney in just a moment. But what I would like to encourage you to do is to listen carefully. It's a big discussion about about her criticism as an Indigenous commentator on the Abbott government. And if you'd like to make any comments or ask any questions, please do. onair@joy.org.au is the email address, or you can SMS us on 0427 joy 949, or you can ring Robert on the front desk on 1300 joy 949. Robert is out on the front desk right now, having sat there all night tonight like a good volunteer that he is, and we love him. And as I said, thank you to Sammy for the wet spot. Very interesting discussion tonight about the role of trans women in the lesbian community. So I hope you all enjoyed that.
I had one listener who happened to come into the studio one week and said hello to Robert at the front desk. She knew exactly who he was because every night at this time we talk about Robert and how wonderful he is, and, of course, all of our other volunteers at Joy as well. Hundreds we have, hundreds, and they're all excellent.
And without our volunteers, over 300 of them, we wouldn't be on air. Including
exactly.
us. We
including
are
us.
All volunteers.
We don't get paid.
Look at James pushing buttons over there.
Doing lots of things. So, yes, we will be speaking to Natalie very shortly, and then later in the show we'll be talking to Matthew Willis, who's a research manager at the Australian Institute of Criminology. I did an interview with him last year about the number of people in prisons, and the ABS has recently released some new data showing that there's even more people in Australian prisons than before. So,
terrific.
I thought this was an appropriate time to be airing this interview for you all.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Hi there, Joysters. You're on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. And we have on the line with us Natalie Crom. Are you there, Natalie?
Yes.
Welcome. And we have had you on our program before, haven't we?
Yes, you have.
And we love speaking with you, so we are very, very happy to have you back.
Thank you very much.
We're always happy having Indigenous voices on this program.
Yes, it's something we, yes, certainly think is very important. So you're a writer working for Independent Australia, and I was interested to talk to you about your most recent article, which was mostly about Tony Abbott. And it's, I guess, pretty clear that you're pretty angry. Can you tell our listeners what you're angry about?
Primarily because Tony Abbott professes himself to be a friend to Indigenous people.
He's going to be the Aboriginal Prime Minister, isn't he?
Yes, and he does absolutely everything in his power to subvert Indigenous people. He starts off by making decisions that cut $600 million from the portfolio. Then he goes out of his way to insult us at every turn. At British conferences, he talks about Australia being like the moon before settlement. He talks about British settlement being
the beginning,
the very first foreign investment in Australia. He's just that kind of class act.
He is, but I did notice that in your article, you actually called him a fascist,
Which he absolutely is.
Which while I don't disagree with that in terms of the colloquial use of fascism, he's not really a fascist in a political theoretical sense of fascism, because
not in the strict political.
He's not the nasty jackbooted promoting genocide, although
he's just really mean and stupid.
Yeah, he's heartless and all those sorts of things. But I don't think we could actually accuse him of genocide and the sorts of things that fascists did. Yet.
And I guess most recently...
I was going to say, if you look at his policies where he continues genocidal policies against Indigenous people, you know, history will tell us the story in a few years.
Well, yeah, I guess
I'd rather not wait for a few years myself.
But I suppose that's the thing, and this is something that, you know, applies to some other areas as well. Like the one that comes to mind is around homophobia. Like if you treat a child in a gay teenager in a way that leads to them to feel so bad about themselves that they commit suicide, like is that manslaughter? And similarly, if you fail to provide the services that people need, is, you know, you are contributing to pretty horrible things, including death. Anyway, and I suppose most recently then there's been the discussion about the closure of remote communities, which is particularly bad. What was your response to that when you heard that news and that those stupid comments?
Ultimately, I just feel like, you know, Aboriginal people just cannot win in this country at the moment. He's dog whistling to his political, I guess, allies out there that share his views, but he's trying to support the cutting of 150 Indigenous communities. He supports a policy that has resulted in the highest rate of children being taken from Indigenous families based on a proven lie. The criminal justice system investigated the claims of pedophilia rings in Aboriginal communities, which led to the intervention, and that was actually proven to be a lie. But children are still being removed at an alarming rate, and Aboriginal people have the highest suicide rate in Australia. It's just that on every front, there's something to be disappointed about, something to be...
How do you get your voice over the voices of people like Warren Mundine and Noel Pearson, for instance, who seem to have the ear of the Prime Minister when it comes to Indigenous voice?
Yeah, they have the ear of the Prime Minister because they largely agree with his policies, unless, of course, he comes out and says something so controversial that they have no choice but to come out and speak against him.
Where does their Aboriginal voice come from?
I guess from their upbringing, from their perspective, from their education, but they definitely don't speak for the larger community, and they definitely don't speak for their own communities, to be honest, because a lot of their own communities are outraged by the views and the pushing of the employment policies and things like that. Of course, we agree that Aboriginal people need to have jobs, but it doesn't have to be at the expense of grassroots policies that seek to advocate for Aboriginal people, as opposed to simply saying, help yourself, get a job, everything else will follow. There's a lot more that needs to be done.
We do have to go to some messages. If you have any, if you'd like to make a comment or ask Natalie a question, you can SMS us on 0427JOY949. That's 0427569949. Email onair@joy.org.au. Also, given that we were just talking about suicide risk, I wanted to give the number for Lifeline, which is 1300 1114, or QLife, which is 1800 184 527. It's 14 minutes past 10.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You're on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. It's 15 minutes past 10. And we have on the line with us Natalie Crom from Sydney, who is an independent Indigenous writer for Independent Australia. Hello there, Natalie. You're still there, aren't you?
Yes, I'm still here.
Good. I want to just ask you a question about creating alliances, because it seems to me that one of the ways in which Aboriginal Australia has advanced, when it has advanced in the political system, is when it's had strong alliances with other sections of the community. Is there a value in creating alliances with asylum seekers, for instance, or with other groups similar thinking groups, and is that possible, and is there dedicated work going on in doing those sorts of things?
I don't think there's any specific dedicated work going on. I think that, you know, there's obviously a lot of minorities who are being subverted by government policy at the moment that are actually, you know, just treading water in their own areas, niche areas, to be honest. But I think that there's definitely some value in that, because the more voices we have pushing a particular agenda against marginalisation, the better.
There is a difference, though, isn't there, with Indigenous people being the First Nation of this country, and therefore it's not it's not quite the same in terms of priority, but it, which means that there needs to be some fairly delicate negotiation, I would have thought, between minority groups if they're allying with Indigenous Australia.
Yeah. I mean, on issues such as civil and political rights, there definitely can be some alliances, but on the issues, you know, there's some definitely niche discussion points that Aboriginal people only can speak to the government about, such as land rights.
And I'll be looking forward to your article on that. That's put you on the spot, hasn't it? Hasn't that awful lot of me?
It has. Something for me to think about.
It would be a good article, though.
Thank you. No, I will work on that.
No, great. I'm not sure if you can hear me there. Natalie, can you hear me?
No. Sorry?
That's all right.
We're having a little technical detail.
Ah, that's why.
Natalie, we have solved that problem. James is here.
Sorry, Natalie, it's James here. I just wanted to ask you, Jim mentioned before about Warren Mundine having the ear of the Prime Minister. Whether you agree or disagree with Warren Mundine, I suppose he's got some very strong opinions on what he'd like to see the future of the Indigenous community, you know, where it head and has key points. What would you say is your different vision for the Indigenous community in Australia, and what that might look like?
And would you be the Indigenous advisor?
Sorry?
Would you be the Indigenous advisor if you were offered it?
Absolutely not. I think the difficulty is that there's so many Aboriginal nations within Australia. It's difficult to speak to all of those, and it's difficult to address all of the unique issues within each community. But I think that my views differ from Warren Mundine's in the sense that I'm less assimilationist. I believe in the beauty of Aboriginal culture. I believe in the right of Aboriginal people to practice their culture without having to engage in the Western system. If they live on their land and they live independently and they would like to maintain their cultural practices, then I believe that they should absolutely be allowed to do that, and without any interference from the government. I believe that Aboriginal people need a right to self-determination. But he has spoken about self-determination, but he's more sort of pushing the employment angle, and I'm not undermining that. I think that that's very important, that Aboriginal people they reach employment parity with the market. I believe in that, but I also think that oversimplification of the issues is the major problem that we're seeing.
Natalie, what about there's been less talk of it recently, but how about education as a key, and particularly language as being a key? Is that something that you're interested in?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely critical, mainly for pride. I think Aboriginal people need to feel a sense of pride that their culture is being maintained, that their language is recognised, that their language is something that's valued and taught and appreciated at school. And a recent discussion with the Minister for Indigenous Affairs, Nigel Scully, and he was in complete agreement with my views that Indigenous history needs to be taught at school so that the children have context and they are basically embarking upon life in Australia without such a tunnel vision that has been of previous generations.
And that's equally as important, isn't it, for non-Indigenous kids, for white kids?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And kids of Asian backgrounds and so on, any immigrant background, people need to be fully aware of where they are and what the context of their new life is.
Because I guess I find it interesting, like, looking at New Zealand as an example, and obviously New Zealand is different for so many reasons, one of the big ones being that, you know, you have one language and there's not the different nations and different language groups. Yeah, many reasons that make them different. But one thing that, I guess, strikes me about New Zealand people is that even, you know, white European, like New Zealand people who are white people of European descent who have only been in New Zealand for one or two generations coming from a European country, they take on Maori culture as their culture and they feel proud to have that history in that country where they were born. And I guess, I don't know, when I see that, I think, oh, that would be so great if Australia had the same. I don't know, what do you think about that, about white Australians taking on Aboriginal culture as their culture too, or their history as well?
I think that's a fantastic sentiment, and I wish it was that way. But I think there's a lot of finger pointing that still occurs with, you know, our country, the government. Whilst it's had the apology, we don't have a treaty, we don't have any formal rights, we don't have constitutional recognition, we don't have any of the things that have, you know, occurred over in New Zealand, in Canada, in America. I think that if we make some monumental steps in our society and have a fundamental shift in the consciousness and have a respect for the Indigenous culture and Indigenous history as opposed to treating them like a burden, this is the constant perpetuating rhetoric in the media that, you know, Aboriginal people are a drain on society, but in fact this society is profiting from the theft of a land from Aboriginal people, and that needs to be understood.
Not to mention, I guess, the ongoing theft with things like particularly tourism comes to mind, and the like white Australian economy benefiting from Australia's Aboriginal history. I guess we do have to finish up soon. One thing I wanted to ask is, I suppose it's quite easy to feel overwhelmed for people who just think, oh, this is so crap, what are we going to do? What would it, are there one or two things that you think, you know, I guess we as allies can be focusing on? Like, is it about the Constitution? Is it about the treaty? Is it about batting down every stupid thing that politicians say? What's kind of top of your list to tackle right now?
Top of my list, personally and from my community, would be a treaty. We think that that's fundamentally important for the investment of Indigenous people. Historically, we've been quite reactionary to the things that have been done to us, and I think that we need to be proactive in banding together and getting a treaty. I understand that it's going to be extremely difficult to get a treaty with each Indigenous nation, so I think that we all need to sort of band together and have our allies band together with us to get a treaty on a large-scale, high-level land rights scale initially, and then hopefully trickle it down to include some further rights.
Yeah, that means a bit of a New Zealand model, because the New Zealand Treaty of Waitangi was not with all the different tribes of New Zealand originally. The last two tribes in the South Island didn't subscribe to it until sometime after the Northern tribes. So it's always an iterative purpose, one would have thought, in these particular things. But a treaty would need to cover, wouldn't it, a number of different things other than just culture, but also also such things as economic rights and education rights and general human rights as a whole.
Yeah.
And, of course, from this radio station, we would hope that it would include the rights of LGBTI Indigenous people.
Absolutely.
Of whom there are quite a few, even though lots of people in the community deny their existence. But, you know, we all know sister girls and brother boys and things like that.
Absolutely. You only need to come to Mardi Gras to see plenty of us.
Absolutely. Well, it's been great talking to you again, and we will get you back again at some stage. I was talking to Jack Charles today, and I'm hoping to get Jack on the program soon to talk about his plans to take his Jack Charles versus the Crown to Canada soon for the big Indigenous arts festivals that are over there.
Jack is wonderful.
And how do you use Indigenous theatre to promote Indigenous culture within the wider Australian culture, and to embed it as a key part of it? So
he's a trailblazer.
He is a wonderful man. So thank you very much for your for your contribution tonight, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Hi there, Joysters. You are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. It's now 31 minutes past 10, and I'm going to do a bit of a shout-out now. Hello there, Rhonda. And just to say to her, you'll be on the show soon, don't worry. I want to talk a bit now, listeners, about some of our upcoming programs that we're planning. We're going to be planning, as I said in that interview with Natalie Crom a minute ago, we're hoping to get Jack Charles, the Aboriginal actor, who has got a fabulous documentary show called Jack Charles versus the Crown, and we're hoping to get Jack onto the program before he leaves for Canada to appear in that show at a number of Indigenous arts festivals across Canada. And we're also hoping to have Rhonda Gaubeli come and talk to us about disability and living a valuable life or something like that, some topic like that. She hasn't heard of the topic yet, but she does know that she's coming. So she'll be listening tonight, so she'll be able to start preparing. And Rhonda, you can contact us on air at joy.org.au on the email if you like, or SMS us on 0427 joy949, that's right, 0427 joy949. What's those numbers for Joy, Steph? You know them.
I do know them. 0427 joy949 or on air at joy.org.au or 1300 joy949.
And what's Joy numbers?
The Joy numbers?
You know that.
They are the Joy numbers.
No, but what are the numbers?
So joyful.
On the keyboard for Joy.
0427 569 949.
That's right. It's always difficult for people that have unsmart smartphones. And we're also hoping to do a program fairly soon at the end of the Comedy Festival, where there's been quite a lot of quite interesting LGBTI comedy and a lot of feminist comedy on Can Feminism Be Funny? And we've got a few comedians lined up for that.
Spoiler alert, yes.
Can it? Are you going to come on that program and tell us yes, Steph?
Sure. Good. Yes, I will. Not that I can be funny, but I can show other people who are a lot funnier than me.
Will you bring some examples with you?
You're the very well-connected one, Mr. Jim Hyde.
Well, we've got a few people that are lined up.
I think you have a few people lined up.
We do. And that'll be, we hope, April the 20th. So listeners, keep listening. And if you want to hear, if you want a topic that you'd like discussed and it's nothing sacred, get on that, get on the on air at joy.org.au or go to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/isnothingsacred, and leave us a message saying what you want. What you want to hear, and we'll do our best to produce a show around it.
We would like that very much. But for now, I have an interview which I did last year with Matthew Willis, who's the research manager at the Australian Institute of Criminology. Now, the reason we're playing this interview now is because I was talking to Matthew last year about the rising number of people in Australian prisons. Then last week, the Australian Bureau of Statistics released some new numbers showing that, surprise, surprise, not for us, that the number of prisoners in Australia had yet again increased. So to give you the actual stats, as at this is the final quarter of 2014, so December 2014, the average number of daily prisoners in Australia was 34,647. If you think that sounds like a lot, you might be interested in this interview.
I wonder how much they cost per day and whether there are any savings
Lots.
To be made there.
It's about $300 per person per day. It's like $900,000. Anyway, it's a lot.
You could put them in a luxury hotel for that.
You could. Probably cheaper. So tonight on the show, we have Matthew Willis, who is a research manager at the Australian Institute of Criminology. Hello, Matthew.
Hi, Stephanie.
Thanks so much for speaking to us. So I'm interested to talk to you this evening about crime in Australia. And anecdotally, there seems to be an increased fear of crime. Are crime rates going up?
No, they're not. The I guess the interesting thing is that rates of pretty much all types of crime are decreasing and have been decreasing for some time. One thing we do know from research, though, is that people's fear of crime or perception of crime isn't necessarily related to the actual crime rates. It can be quite different, and usually what happens is that the fear of crime is much greater than the reality of crime.
So if fear of crime is not associated with crime rates, what is causing the increase in the fear of crime, do you think?
I think a lot of the increase in fear of crime is linked to media reporting, and I'm not suggesting that's a bad thing at all, but high-profile cases that get a lot of media attention get people thinking and worried, and it's something that people tend to dwell on a lot when they hear of crimes occurring. Perhaps someone they know may have had their car stolen, just as an example, or they may hear or read about assaults that have occurred. That then leads to people thinking about that in relation to themselves and then making an assumption that those incidents are much wider spread than in most cases they actually are.
Mm. Something else that I've read about is about prisons expanding in Australia, and I know that's happening here in Victoria and in Queensland as well. If crime is going down, why are prisons expanding?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting question. I guess probably the main thing to understand about that is that crime rates and, in fact, imprisonment rates, neither of those are necessarily ideal measures of criminal behaviour or criminal activity. And I know that doesn't kind of make sense intuitively, but what crime rates and imprisonment rates are measuring are the actual crime that's being committed and people's criminal behaviour, but there's only ever a certain proportion of that that results in people being arrested. There's only a certain proportion that's detected that then results in people being arrested, and then there's a smaller proportion again that is prosecuted, and a smaller proportion again that results in imprisonment as opposed to a whole range of other outcomes such as fines or community-based orders. So what crime rates and imprisonment rates tend to do is reflect that criminal behaviour, but also activity within the criminal justice system. So they can sometimes be a measure of policing activity, and if you put greater resources into policing, you'll generally end up with a greater proportion of crimes being detected and a greater proportion of arrests. If you have policies that lead to harsher sentencing or sentences that are more likely to result in imprisonment, that then leads to an increase in imprisonment rates. And if you have changes in policies or laws that are more likely to lead to people being in prison, that again does it. So in that case, talking about things like changes to bail laws that we have seen in quite a few jurisdictions that remove presumptions of bail. And what that means is that people who might previously have been released on bail actually stay in prison on remand. And quite a high proportion of our prison populations, this varies from one jurisdiction to another, but quite a high proportion at any given point are people who are on remand. So they're usually people who haven't been convicted yet, and a smaller proportion who have been convicted but haven't been sentenced. So those kinds of laws that change whether people are likely to get bail have a direct impact on imprisonment rates. Some recent research that has been done in New South Wales, looking specifically at the increase in imprisonment rates there, found that one of the big factors was a higher rate of arrests for serious offences. So there weren't necessarily more serious offences being committed, but people who did commit them were more likely to be arrested and, in a lot of cases, ultimately imprisoned because of an increase in police resources. They also found an increased proportion of people overall who were arrested who were receiving imprisonment. Some other changes that have happened in Victoria recently have been the abolition of suspended sentences. So with that not being there as a sentencing option, that has led to an increase in people receiving imprisonment, whereas in other cases previously they might have received that sentence of imprisonment but had it suspended, so they in fact, didn't spend that time in prison. They were in the community. And there's also evidence that links increased breaches of community-based orders. There might be parole orders, or it might be something like a community service order, where people are breached for not complying with the conditions of that order, that then leads to them being imprisoned instead. And they're actions that aren't necessarily picked up in crime rates, because when the person first committed the crime, that may be reflected in the crime rates, but if they're then breached for not complying with their conditions, that's not necessarily reflected in the crime rates that people look at, but it does result in the higher number of people going to prison.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Hi there, Joysters. You're on as Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. And we've been listening to a very fascinating interview that Steph did with Matthew Willis, who's the research manager at the Australian Institute of Criminology, some time ago. And we're playing it at the moment because of the release of Australian Bureau of Statistics crime stats that came out showing that there are 34,000 people in jail every day in Australia at the moment, which is quite appalling when you think about it. And we do have a message about this from Dean from World Wide Wave, who's one of the presenters on World Wide Wave, which is one of our sister programs. And Dean says, such a fascinating interview, great work. Well, thank you, Dean. We think World Wide Wave's pretty fascinating and interesting too.
We do. It's one of our favourites.
It is.
So we have the next part of the interview, talking with Matthew Willis from the Australian Institute of Criminology.
From a research perspective, so you've talked about some of the rises of in imprisonment being around policies and policing and, I guess, shifts in perceptions of crime rather than crime itself. And I guess I'm curious, from a research perspective, does having more people in prison make society safer overall?
Not necessarily. What happens, prison serves a number of purposes, and the extent to which those different purposes are emphasised varies across time and varies across different places. One of the genuine purposes of imprisonment is incapacitation. So it's basically taking people out of society so they're incapacitated or prevented from committing further offences. And that certainly does have an impact on crime for those people. We certainly know of cases where people are able to continue running drug operations from inside prisons, for example. They're relatively isolated cases, but it does occur. But certainly people who have been breaking into houses or committing assault and so on in the community are incapacitated and prevented from doing that. Whether putting more people in prison has any impact on deterrence preventing people from committing crime in the first place is probably a different question, and most of the research suggests that imprisoning people and certainly imposing longer sentences does not really have an impact on deterrence at all. And the other, I guess, main purpose is around rehabilitation. And that's something where when people are in prison, they're typically able to receive rehabilitation programs, which might be behavioural programs that focus on their offending behaviour, might be things like vocational and educational programs. Now, they certainly do, well-designed and well-implemented programs, certainly do have an impact on people's likelihood of reoffending, but there's always quite a high proportion of the prison population that never receives those kinds of programs. I mentioned earlier the high proportions of people on remand. People on remand don't receive those kinds of programs, and people serving short sentences, so people are going in for, say, 2 or 3 months, typically won't receive any kind of rehabilitation programs, or they might be quite limited in their scope.
Can you explain to our listeners what it means to be on remand?
Oh, sorry, yes. Being on remand is when you're being held in prison, for example, if you commit an assault, you're taken before the court, and the court might determine that the because you're a risk of committing a similar offence, or you're a risk of kind of escaping and not appearing in court, or you generally present a risk to the community still, the court might order that you be remanded, which means you remain in custody until your trial. And then people who are tried, especially in the higher courts, maybe the case that they're tried, found guilty, and then the court hands down a sentence sometime later, those people will then be held in prison awaiting that sentence.
One group that I know has higher rates of imprisonment are Aboriginal people, and I know that those rates are much higher than for other Australians. What are the things that are leading to this high imprisonment rate for Aboriginal people, and I guess what can we do about it?
Yeah, that's a very good question with ultimately a very complex answer. And the high rates of Aboriginal imprisonment link back to the levels of socioeconomic disadvantage that a lot of Aboriginal people and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people across Australia face. Socioeconomic disadvantage is a huge predictor of your likelihood of being involved in offending, and that's something that Indigenous people tend to experience more than the rest of the population. Other big predictors are things like unemployment, for example, or low levels of education. And there, again, are things that are disproportionately experienced by the Indigenous population.
Hello, Joysters. It is 8 minutes to 11. We are doing playing an interview that I did last year with Matthew Willis from the Australian Institute of Criminology.
And it's a great interview too, Steph.
Thanks, Jim.
Very perceptive questions.
We're about to go back. I just wanted to remind you, if you've just tuned in, this is an interview I did last October. So it does refer to an upcoming election, which is the Victorian election of 2014. But the answers are still very interesting and relevant. So we're going to play anyway. Enjoy. Does that mean that if there were policies to, I guess, reduce socioeconomic disadvantage or to improve employment or education, then that may have an impact on crime rates?
Yeah, that's right. And governments right around Australia, in each of the states and territories and nationally, are, you know, we know, putting a lot of work into addressing these kinds of problems. They're complex problems. They're entrenched and very deep-seated problems, so they do take time to address. But over time, if we can reduce some of that disadvantage, that will ultimately reduce levels of crime. One of the big problems that faces the Indigenous population is that one of the other really big predictors of going to prison is whether you've ever been to prison before. Mm. And we know that Indigenous Australians have rates of prior imprisonment or previous imprisonment that are, again, much higher than the overall population. So that tends to have a bit of a cyclic effect.
Mm. I know that some of the research you've done has been about people leaving prison. So, of course, there'd be lots of different stories, but is there a typical experience or trends in what happens when people leave prison?
Yeah, and I think the 27 is a typical story. It varies a fair bit depending on how long people have been in prison. As mentioned, people who have short sentences, that's people who spend, say, 2 or 3 months in prison, that's not enough time for them to really have received much in the way of support or rehabilitative programs. But that's more than enough time for them to lose any accommodation they might have had, employment they might have had. We know that a lot of people go into prison in situations where they're unemployed and they don't have stable accommodation. To the extent they do, that's often lost over time. So support programs that provide assistance into employment and into accommodation are really important. Programs that assist people with drug and alcohol use as well are really important. are unfortunately quite high rates of mortality from people coming out of prison. So people who've been in prison for a time, went in with drug use problems, return to the community, start using drugs again, and often will use those at higher levels than they did before, or without the kind of levels of tolerance that they built up before. So we do see quite a lot of people, you know, there are high rates of people dying from drug overdose in the periods after leaving prison, and that's a really risky period. For people who've been in prison longer, simply the experience of having been removed from the community for that amount of time can make it really hard for some people just to get on with their normal lives, and just those sort of things that we take for granted as part of the normal, I guess, pressures of life, like, you know, paying your rent and doing your shopping and managing your budgets and so on, can be extremely hard for people. They're hard things for anyone who's on limited levels of income. And in some ways they're even harder when you've been separated from the community and those kinds of routine activities for a long period of time. So that's where really good post-release support is critical.
Mm. Well, I guess for us here in Victoria, one thing that we're aware of is the upcoming election next month, and often there's a lot of discussion around law and order and crime and justice around election time. What if in the upcoming election, what would you be hoping for in terms of good policy that would have positive effects on reducing crime in Victoria?
I guess while I will be careful about commenting too much on any specific policies, what I'd really be hoping to see is just good evidence-based policy, policies that take account of the research evidence that is out there, take account of what's been shown to be effective, and policies that really take into account the needs of people right across the community, and particularly those people coming from situations of disadvantage and situations where they may have grown up experiencing violence and abuse and trauma, and they can be huge, huge factors leading to involvement in offending. So just really good, solid, evidence-based programs that deal with the factors that lead to offending in the first place are always valuable.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Hello, it is 1 minute to 11, so it's time to say goodnight. Thank you very much, everyone, for joining us. Thank you very much to Natalie Crom for speaking with us today, and also Matthew Willis from last year from the Australian Institute of Criminology. Jim, farewell.
Good night, everybody, and don't forget to message us on our Facebook page with topics that you'd like us to do a show on.
We would like that very much. All right, and next up we have a little pod of joy. So enjoy, on Joy. Good night.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.